Sebastian Lai, son of imprisoned Catholic democracy advocate Jimmy Lai, is here to talk about his father's health and the Hong Kong trial wrapping up this week. And the world came to Washington seeking a peace deal between Ukraine and Russia. Meanwhile, the conflict in Gaza rages. Defense and geopolitics expert John Rossomondo weighs in. The World Over begins right now.
Now, Raymond DeRoy.
A warm welcome to all of you joining us in the United States and the world over. An important show for you this week. If you'd like to comment, send me an X post. I'm at Raymond Arroyo. I'm also at Arroyo Grande Show on YouTube. Catholic democracy advocate and media magnate Jimmy Lai has been jailed in Hong Kong since December of 2020. The Chinese government claims he violated China's national security law for, among other things, his role in pro-democracy demonstrations in 2019. And this week, the prosecution began closing arguments in Jimmy's trial as his health continues to decline. Joining me with an update on his father's fight is Jimmy's son, Sebastian Lai. Sebastian, thanks for being here. Your dad, Jimmy, has pled not guilty to two charges of colluding with foreign powers under that national security law I mentioned, and a separate charge of sedition he also has said he's not guilty of. He faces life in prison if he's convicted. In his closing arguments, the prosecutor emphasized Jimmy's international connections, which included prominent U.S. political figures. And the defense lawyer has argued that his support of freedom of speech and expression are neither wrong nor criminal. Your thoughts on the closing arguments so far?
I think, look, my father's, you know, as you mentioned, been in jail for the last 5 years. He's been on trial on and off for those last 5 years, but his national security law trial is still not finished. It's almost 5 years in. And so for the last year and a half, he essentially had all these evidence brought against him. And all that turned out to be completely untrue. It turns out my father is in prison because of his journalism and because of his courage, because he stayed to defend his people, because he dared to campaign for democracy and for human rights in Hong Kong. And that didn't sit well with the Hong Kong government. So it's this incredibly heartbreaking moment where they have a 77-year-old that is in not great health, and that, you know, unfortunately might pass away at any time. But it's also this very powerful moment where there's this man who landed in Hong Kong when he was 12, and you know, running away from communist China, and in his 70s decided to stay and defend his principles, defend his journalists, and this is his sacrifice. That's what he's in jail for. Yeah. So obviously incredibly worried and incredibly heartbreaking, but I think, you know, I hope the world sees how much freedom matters to my father and to the people of Hong Kong.
Well, the Hong Kong government and really the mainland government claim he agitated foreign governments and urged them via his articles, via his journalism, to sanction the Chinese government in Hong Kong. And his defense attorney said, this is armchair punditry. But my question is, will that free speech argument hold up in China, Sebastian, under this regime?
So unfortunately, the national security law is so broad. And you know, the premise that Hong Kong styles of rule of law no longer holds. I mean, to give you an example, my father got more than a year in maximum security prison in solitary confinement on one of the sentences, which was for lighting a candle and saying a prayer at a Tiananmen Square massacre vigil. This is, I think anybody watching this knows how, not just ridiculous, but how horrible it is to give someone a jail sentence over commemorating people who died for freedom and democracy in China. And so now we're now in a situation where, you know, look, my father said it best, I think, in when he was giving testimony. He's like, look, my job as a journalist, as a publisher, is to hold a torch to the truth. And you know, as you know, as a journalist, that's your role. That's what you have to do, no matter how hard it is. And that's what he was doing.
No, and they come after
if they
you.
Didn't, yeah. And if they didn't like the truth, then that's what they do to you in Hong Kong. Hmm. So it's a textbook example of a show trial, of a weaponization of the legal system.
Yeah.
And you know, my father's still fighting. My father's still holding on.
What are you hearing from people in Hong Kong or on the mainland? Are they able to follow your father's case, or is the news being suppressed?
It's a open trial, so they could still follow it in Hong Kong. Obviously, we are in a situation now where there's a free press in Hong Kong.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. They sent, you know, 500 journalists to raid my father's newspaper, arrested his colleagues. You know, people are going to jail for liking social media posts or even writing on, you know, bathroom toilets. So it's essentially culled. But foreign journalists can still go, and local journalists can still cover parts of it. So it's still at least, there's at least that element of it. And from my understanding, my father is much, much skinnier and much weaker, but still, you know, still strong in spirit and still strong in mind.
Sebastian, during last year's presidential election, President Trump said on a podcast that, quote, 100% I'll get him out. He'll be easy to get out, end quote. Then last Thursday, in what appeared to be a toned down version of that earlier pledge, Trump said in an interview on Fox News Radio that he would do everything he could. Listen.
I didn't say 100% I'd save him. I said 100% I'm going to be bringing it up. And I've already brought it up. And I'm going to do everything I can to save him.
Sebastian, the president added that his Chinese counterpart, Xi Jinping, would not be exactly thrilled by the pressure campaign to free Jimmy. What are you hearing from the administration? Are they communicating with you?
Oh, so we're incredibly grateful that the president said that. Look, I think there's so many things happening around the world, and this is the busiest man in the world. The fact that he's still keeping my father's case close to heart is something that I'm incredibly grateful for, and I'm incredibly grateful that he said that he would do all that he can to free him. The president and the administration knows the communication with China, you know, much more than I ever would. But I think we are in a situation now where my father dying in jail is not beneficial for any party. It's not beneficial for Hong Kong. It's not beneficial for China. It's obviously not beneficial for anybody who enjoys freedom, who is willing to, would do the same in my father's situation, was willing to stand for the principles that he stood for. Mm. Freeing him for Hong Kong and China is a very easy way to sort of get rid of this problem. Just say, like, look, this man's 77, he's going to die at any point. He's a hero to many around the world. We could just put him on a plane and send him to the US or to the UK. It'll take you 2-3 hours, and that's it, and that's done. And we don't have this person who essentially would act as a martyr if he died in prison. So I think that's the context at which at least I'm looking at the situation. And it's optimistic, but that's how I'm looking at it.
Sebastian, Father Robert Sirico, the founder of the Acton Institute, a frequent guest on this show, told CNA at the start of your father's trial that he had little hope that the Chinese government would allow Jimmy to walk free. He said, quote, there is no jury. The three judges are handpicked by Hong Kong's chief executive, who is under the thumb of the CCP. These judges hold lies fate in their hands, end quote. Do you think your father will see justice here? Is it even possible, given what Father Sirico laid out there?
Yeah, so he's not going to see a fair trial. There's no chance. You know, on top of what you said, there's allegations of witnesses being tortured to give testimony. So it's an absolute kangaroo trial. It's an absolute show trial, which is why, you know, we're so grateful that the president said that he will try his hardest to free my father, because my father's never going to get a fair trial. Anybody looking at what's happening to my father sees the destruction of the rule of law in Hong Kong, sees this place that used to be vibrant, used to be a financial center, essentially based on trust and rules being broken down. It's the instead of the rule of law, it's the rule of man.
Yeah. It should not be forgotten, Jimmy Lai, as well as yourself, are British citizens. So when you were last here, we discussed what the UK government should be doing to secure his release. And the UK Prime Minister told Parliament last October that Jimmy Lai's case was, quote, a priority, and he called for his release. Has the government taken any practical steps to bring that about?
I don't know what happens. I don't know what the inner conversation is between our government and the UK government and the Chinese or Hong Kong government. Mm-hmm. But you know, I think it's time to put action to word. The US government is much more effective and much stronger in terms of liberating its people around the world. Now that we have both governments are so supportive, I think it's a good. It gives us a lot of hope as a family. But I think, look, I hope I hope the UK government can obviously do more to free my father. You know, again, it's been 5 years. His health is not good.
I want to talk about his health. Concerns over his deteriorating health, which we've seen as these proceedings have gone on. I mean, just to put this in context for those of you watching. Jimmy Lai has been held for more than 1,600 days, much of that in solitary confinement, with his legal team highlighting his weight loss, the risk posed by diabetes. Sebastian, on August 15th, Jimmy's lawyer said he recently experienced heart palpitations while in prison and had at times felt like he was collapsing. Yet the Hong Kong government says a medical examination of your father found no abnormalities and that the medical care he received was adequate. What's the reality?
Well, I mean, the reality is that you have this man who's in his 70s in solitary confinement. They essentially put him in a little concrete cell, and there's no air conditioning, so he bakes under the sun. Hong Kong goes up to 30, 40 degrees Celsius in the summer, and so it goes up to 30, 40 degrees Celsius now, and he essentially bakes in this little concrete box. Never mind his diabetes, never mind the fact that they're always trying to essentially break his spirit with all these multiple show trials. It's just basic biology that a man who goes through this would have his health massively degrade, and we are in a situation now where unfortunately my father's health has gotten worse and worse and worse. Obviously hearing about heart palpitations makes me very, very worried, and I don't know how much longer he has. I know his faith is a very strong pillar,
yeah,
of who he is, why he did this, but it's that's why I'm so grateful that so many people pray for him, because it's what's keeping him very strong.
We learned this week he's wearing a heart monitor and receiving medication. And my question is, if everything's normal, why is he wearing a heart monitor and receiving medication? None of that makes sense to me. But Sebastian,
exactly.
Given what you've seen so far in this endless trial, I mean, this has dragged on for 5 years now. From the imprisonment to now the end of the trial. What are you seeing in these closing arguments that are giving you hope? And how can people support you, your family, and your father's freedom?
In terms of what's given me hope in this trial and the closing arguments, I think it's words that my father said, in one of the heated exchanges with the judges when he was on testimony. My father, at the end of the exchange, my father essentially said, "Look, in the end day, the truth will come out in the kingdom of God, and that is good enough for me." And I think that is such a strong phrase, because this is a man who sacrificed everything that he has to stand up for his belief and his principles and his journalists. So I think, look, if anybody watching this, and I know many people watch this, can pray for him, can follow the story along, learn more about my father's story, about this man who's given everything that he has for freedom and democracy, and just follow along, keep pressure on the Hong Kong government and Chinese government, and your prayers go a long way, especially when he's in a little a concrete cell and by himself, and the, you know, the government tells him that nobody cares about him and that he's gonna die for nothing.
Are you disappointed, Sebastian, that we haven't heard more from the church, from the Vatican, and the church in Hong Kong? There is a church there. There's an archbishop there. I know Cardinal Zen, the former archbishop of Hong Kong, has been extremely supportive, or former bishop of Hong Kong, rather, has been very supportive of your father and your family. What about the larger church?
I mean, we've had a lot of support from the Catholic communities around the world, including incredibly strong support in America, which we've been so incredibly grateful for. In terms of the Vatican, yes, we haven't. I guess we haven't gotten the support that you know, one would assume for a man whose faith guided him to do the right thing and is being persecuted for his courage. You know, but I am hopeful. I am hopeful that. I am hopeful because under any scenario and worldview, my father did the right thing, and I think that it's the Vatican's responsibility to support one person who has done the right thing, especially when faith is what's holding him so strong.
Yeah, and his Catholic faith has sustained him in this true war to bring about freedom, not only of persons, but of spirit and minds. And he sacrificed everything, sacrificed his media empire, and now he's put his life on the line. The least diplomats can do is engage and join that fight. Sebastian Lai, I thank you so much for being here. Our prayers are with you, your father, the entire family. We will stay on this story. Thank you for your time, and we'll check back in the days and weeks ahead.
Thank you so much. Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you, Sebastian. And this week on the Arroyo Grande podcast, I sat down with the filmmaker behind Amazon's epic series, House of David, John Irwin. And we talked about how he rediscovered the hero's journey and how you can find your own. And I have a commentary on the sorority rushes at universities, which you must see. If you've spent any time on Instagram or TikTok, you've probably seen these sorority rush videos. The Wall Street Journal reports that these videos have become a global phenomenon. Great. The world now thinks our college girls spend their days wearing mini skirts, bumping and grinding on the front lawn of their sorority houses. Move over, Susan B. Anthony. Can I ask a question? Are you auditioning to work at Hooters or a gentleman's club? Why exactly are you doing these raunchy dances on the front lawn? Rush Week used to be a time when girls visited various sororities for interviews. They had time to bond with others, people who might become lifelong friends. They had brunches and teas, wore nice gowns. And yeah, looks and polish were always a part of it. But they didn't spend their time mimicking Cardi B and recording it. Why have these women, focused on accomplishment, decided that twerking and push-up bras are the path to success? You don't need a diploma to do that kind of work. And why would a smart girl want to be a part of a group that prizes getting down more than growing up? Now, look, I'm all for pretty girls dancing around on the lawn. Have at it. But I'm also a dad. And if that were my daughter, and if this is what she has to do to get into a Greek house, she can find a different pantheon. The full Arroyo Grande interview with John Irwin is up on YouTube at Arroyo Grande Show, or wherever you get your podcasts, Spotify, Apple, iHeart, everywhere. And be sure to subscribe so you don't miss an Arroyo Grande episode. Friday's prayerful posse, by the way, is a barn burner. Pope Leo casts off the idols, and are those conversions really on the rise? Don't miss it. Visit RaymondArroyo.com. All the links are there. With President Trump's recent meeting with Russian President Vladimir Putin in Alaska, and then the summit with Vladimir Zelensky and the European leaders this week in Washington, what are the chances of a peace deal? With analysis, I'm joined by defense and geopolitical analyst John Rossomondo. John, thanks for being here. Look, on Tuesday night, despite talks between the U.S., Russia, Moscow continued its aerial bombardment of Ukraine, including an overnight attack that targeted oil and port facilities in Odessa. Zelensky said on Wednesday that more than 60 drones and ballistic missiles were fired across Ukraine overnight. Your thoughts on this, particularly following this much ballyhooed meeting between Trump and Putin in Alaska, what was gained, if anything?
Well, I think that it was a start. You know, you always have a start of a conversation. I think that Putin is trying to get what he can get on the battlefield so that he gets the most favorable terms of any sort of peace agreement that he can get with Zelensky. Mm-hmm.
Tell me, give me a sense of, are we going to have a land swap here? I mean, and I want you to talk about the history of Ukraine. There's a huge misunderstanding here, yeah. John. I mean, this was essentially a Russian satellite for many, many, many years, since what, 1870-something or 1890-something. Then the Soviet Union falls, and Ukraine declares its independence. Speak for a moment about the history here, the territory. The Russians say this is Russian territory.
Well, if you look at Ukraine's remote history, it was Kievan Rus, you know, which the Russians see as the cradle of their civilization. The Ukrainians, you know, say, no, you're the Muscovites and so forth. But really, the Ukrainian identity was formed by the fact it was part of the Polish-Lithuanian Commonwealth until the time of Catherine the Great, when it was annexed.
Right.
And Ukraine means in the Slavic language, the frontier. So the Russians, you know, don't view Ukraine as, it's like, you know, the U.S. losing Pennsylvania or something like that in their Russian psyche. I mean, what, you know, Sun Tzu, the Chinese philosopher said, you have to understand how your opponent thinks in order to beat them. We're not trying to do that.
And Putin wants to put together the old Soviet Union. That's really what he's trying to restore. I mean, he sees himself as a successor to Peter the Great.
Absolutely. Not just the Soviet Union.
Uh-huh.
A successor to the Russian Tsarist Russian Empire. You look at the uniforms that Putin's presidential guard wears. They're basically the guards of Alexander III from the 19th century. The Russian Navy has restored some of the orders that were given in the Tsarist period.
But you already have Trump coming out and saying Ukraine is not getting Crimea. Crimea was that the island, as you mentioned, Catherine the Great invaded it in the 1800s. But Putin moved in 2012 during Obama's presidency, and nobody did anything. That was Crimea. He had it. He's got it. And so Trump is saying you're not going to get Crimea back. And Zelensky, you're not going to join NATO. Your thoughts?
Well, my thoughts is Trump is doing the pragmatic thing, because one thing people are talking about is all the hundreds of thousands of people who have been killed on the battlefield, the damage to the Russian economy.
Yeah.
Ideology trumps any sort of reasoned dialogue. And as far as Putin's idea, this is part of the Russian Empire. I mean, after 2014, he was talking about Novorossiya, which was part of, you know, Ottoman Turkey that was seized by Catherine the Great. That is part of Russia, and say, referring to everything. That's all the area pretty much that Putin occupies in eastern and southern Ukraine.
The Donbass, the Crimea. They're talking about security guarantees that are going to be a big part of this. President Trump said Tuesday U.S. troops would not be sent to defend Ukraine against Russia, though he did leave open the possibility of some kind of coalition force of Europeans and the U.S. to protect the border of Ukraine. Are we headed to another DMZ zone like Korea?
Well, I think that's what we're going to end up seeing, because you have a situation where Putin is not going to pull out. The Ukrainians will not recognize under their constitution the loss of what Putin refers to as Novorossiya. And, you know, you'll probably have the Europeans in there indefinitely, and us throwing weapons at the Ukrainian army so that it can hold out against a Russian follow-up invasion.
President Zelensky made sure to show his gratitude repeatedly to President Trump during that Oval Office meeting on Monday. Nine times, I counted, he thanked Trump. That was in the first minute of his public address, okay? I guess after his last disastrous Oval Office visit, he kind of learned the approach here. What do you make of that cadre of European leaders that were there? And aside from optics, what did their participation achieve or not?
Well, I think that their participation achieved trying to build consensus with Europeans who are terrified of a Russian invasion. I mean, Sweden had not fought a war in 200 years. Yet, as a result of its invasion, the Ukraine invasion, mm-hmm. it joined NATO. Finland was neutral throughout all the Cold War. It joined NATO. So basically, it's a way of Trump trying to reassure the Europeans that they will not be forgotten and they will not face a Russian invasion if they go along with whatever he has is trying to put together.
Putin seems cold to the entire idea of a bilateral meeting with Zelensky now. So where are we at this point? Do the sanctions go on? There were promised sanctions that Trump, he's been pounding them and beating them with sanctions that has damaged. I mean, this is a ragged economy in Russia, but it doesn't seem to be softening Putin up.
Well, ideology, like I said, Raymond, we're not talking about somebody who has a rational ideology. Mm-hmm. We're talking about, I mean, it's on part of, on par with communism, you know, during the Soviet era. I mean, they put, no matter how bad their economy got, they kept pushing, you know, communism. Putin is pushing this Slavophile Pan-Slavic nationalism that the czars promoted in the 19th century.
Yeah, the restoration of the empire. And that's a missing piece here. I think people just don't get that. That hasn't sunk in. What's really driving him? And that these sanctions, all of this may not deter him either. Pope Leo's called for a day of prayer and fasting on August 22nd for peace. He's asking people to join in prayer. Hopefully that will bear some fruit. Let's talk about Ukraine and the impact this is having on Ukrainian Catholics and those in the Eastern Church. What's happening there?
Well, let me just give you a little hit. Our viewers probably aren't familiar with the Ukrainian Catholic Church. It was a Eastern Orthodox that joined with Rome in the 16th century. They were banned by Stalin. In the areas of Ukraine that are occupied by Russia, the Catholic Church has been banned, and priests have been imprisoned in favor of the Russian Orthodox Church, which I would implore President Trump to bring to Putin's attention to free the Catholic Church in eastern Ukraine.
You know, this is the same routine Catherine the Great pulled. When she moved into Crimea, they brought the Russian, you know, the Russian faith and expelled all the largely Muslim Tartars who were there, right?
Absolutely. I mean, one thing people don't understand is the Russian way of war, the Russian mentality, you know, great Russia.
No cultural occupation in addition to, you know, fearsome warriors. Now, this week, Israel launched a new offensive in Gaza City. In the midst of a starvation crisis in the region, more than 62,000 people have been killed during Israel's offensive so far. According to Gaza's health ministry, and the ministry is part of the Hamas-run government. It's unclear how many of those people are civilians or combatants. They say half of them are women and children. In addition to that toll, hundreds have died of malnutrition-related causes since the start of this war. Israel's military said Wednesday that it will call up 60,000 reservists ahead of an expanded military operation in Gaza. John, peace seems remote by the day.
Well, I think that when it comes to a lot of the statistics, we're dealing with the fog of war. You know, we don't know how many people have died because Hamas, according to a University of Pennsylvania statistician, uses fake numbers. And we don't know, you know, the Israelis have, you know, their propaganda.
Yeah, they have a different set
thing.
Of numbers.
So
yeah.
It's just sort of like it's hard to know. But at the same time, we have to look at the human suffering. I mean, and Hamas is a savage and sadistic organization.
Yeah.
The thing about all the tunnels they built under schools, under hospitals, and use human shields. I mean, it's horrible, you know, the bombings that the Israelis have, you know, done that have harmed innocent civilians, but we also have to look who is responsible for bringing that. Hamas doesn't want to give up the hostages.
No, it's horrible. I want to get your take as a counterterrorism expert on what we're seeing on the southern border. The Trump administration has targeted these drug cartels, which have already been designated as terrorist organizations. not a mention of the situation, not to mention that situation between the U.S. and Venezuela. Nicolas Maduro is calling up more than 4 million militia members down there to counter the threat of U.S. action after the Trump administration more than doubled the bounty on Maduro. I want to play what Marco Rubio told me a few weeks ago. Listen to this. Your State Department designated six cartels in Latin America as terrorist organizations. How did that change the way, the interaction between these cartels and the United States? And who made that decision?
Well, the president makes a decision on our recommendation. Here's the thing. We cannot continue to just treat these guys as local street gangs. Mm-hmm. They have weaponry that looks like what terrorists, in some cases armies, have. They control territory in many cases. Those cartels extend from the Maduro regime in Venezuela, which is not a legitimate government. We don't recognize the Maduro regime as legitimate. It is a criminal enterprise, all the way to the various different cartels that operate in Mexico. And in between, you find them in Ecuador, you find them in Guatemala, you find TDA, what people would call street gangs, but actually are operating as criminal enterprises, but very well organized ones. So what it changes is it gives us legal authorities to target them in ways you can't do if they're just a bunch of criminals. It's no longer a law enforcement issue. Mm-hmm. It becomes a national security issue.
Has it changed their behavior at all?
Well, I don't know if it's changed their behavior yet, but their behavior is going to have to change one way or another. But it allows us to now target what they're operating and to use other elements of American power, intelligence agencies, the Department of Defense, whatever, to target these groups if we have an opportunity to do it. We have to start treating them as armed terrorist organizations, not simply drug dealing organizations. Right. Drug dealing is the kind of terrorism they're doing, and it's not the only.
Yeah.
You know, they also are into human trafficking, they smuggle anything, and there's been nascent cooperation between them and some international terrorist organizations in the past, which pose an ongoing danger to the United States.
Your reaction?
Well, my reaction is that, Maduro is a good part of the problem that we have with the migrant flows. And also, Maduro is allied with Russia and with China and with Iran. So this is, the nexus of what we're seeing overseas. We have a lot of people in America who say, we shouldn't be worried about, China, Russia. It's not our Iran. It's not our thing. But they're manipulating them. They're involved in the drug trafficking. Iran takes drugs from Afghanistan, brings it through Venezuela, and we have to deal with this problem. And the one thing that people I've talked to in the intelligence community, current and former, worry that we carry out attacks against the cartels in Mexico, we're going to start seeing attacks inside the U.S. like Mexico faces now.
Do you foresee special forces dropping in on these cartels in Mexico and in Venezuela?
I'll just say if President Trump orders it, yes. But then we also have to be prepared for the blowback on American soil. Our police need to be paying attention. The CIA and our intelligence agencies need to keep local law enforcement informed about what is going on, because this can really get out of hand.
Speaking of local law enforcement, I want to talk about what's happening here in D.C. FBI Director Kash Patel said on Wednesday on X, 550 people have been arrested in Washington, D.C. since Trump federalized the Metropolitan Police Department. Now, John, the problem is the federal presence is usually temporary. I mean, we saw that in L.A. We saw it in my native New Orleans. Once the guard goes, crime kind of returns to normal. And Trump is doing a ride along with law enforcement tonight, by the way.
Well, I think that, somebody has lived in the D.C. area for more than 20 years, who lived through the D.C. riots in 2020. You used to be able to go to your CVS and not have things locked up. Now everything is locked up. You have, people down in Navy Yard, that was the up-and-coming neighborhood, being raped, murdered,
carjacked,
and so forth. It's, sad to see this, but you've had Muriel Bowser in the Democratic-led city council that has allowed this. They reduced the hours for their police, and now we're getting the results of their lousy governance, and President Trump is having to step in to be the adult in the room.
Yeah, well, he can do that in the district because it's a federal territory. But I'm not sure about bringing the National Guard to other cities that have their own you know, municipal government.
Well, I think that that's, you know, certainly something that I don't know that I would, you know, consider. Yeah. But I think that President Trump needs to be working with the local Democratic politicians to bring them to Washington and have a summit about solving the crime problem because, yeah. you know, you have cities in this country where it's out of hand.
Yeah, like national security. Public safety should not be a partisan issue. It isn't a partisan issue, and it's sad that it becomes one. John, thank you so
much. Thank you, Raymond.
According to recent statistics, over half of marriages in the U.S. end in divorce. What are the leading stressors in those relationships that cause marriages to fail? And how can couples avoid the mistake that can often doom a relationship? My next guest is a clinical psychologist, longtime host of The Doctor Is In on EWTN Radio. He's also the father of 10 adopted children, and he's here tonight to offer some techniques to strengthen your marriage and share his appropriately titled new book, Simple Steps to a Stronger Marriage. Please welcome Dr. Ray Guarendi. Ray, thanks for being here. I want to start with the CDC statistics. Nearly 700,000 couples in the U.S. reported divorce in 2021 alone. That's about half of the number of marriages reported that same year. What, in your experience as a marriage and family counselor, what is driving those numbers and the high rates of divorce?
I want to preface this, Raymond, by saying I'm getting a little tired of having to write books just to get on your show.
Well, that's how that's the fast pass. You write a book, you get to come on if it's a good book. And so you pass the first part of the test. We'll see how long this interview lasts.
A lot of those stats are second marriages, third marriages. The statistics on second marriage is 66%. The statistics on third is 90%. So that's a bit skewed. Better stats are about 40% of first-time marriages end in divorce. That's still pathetic. Why is this? Overall, one, you give God the boot. You don't have the commitment. Multiple secular studies indicate as religion goes, marriage goes. That's straightforward.
Yeah, no, that's so important. And again, a component rarely discussed or mentioned, but there is that third person in the marriage that you need to consider and welcome in early on. Let's talk for a moment about some of the most common reasons given for divorce. These include things like career choices, parenting differences, division of household labor, relationships with family and friends, and finances, according to a Forbes survey. The top two reasons given were career choices and parenting differences. Does that mesh with what you see in your practice?
About 80% of marriages, Raymond, end because I don't like you anymore. I don't want to be around you. I don't want to live with you anymore. That's about 80% of them. The bulk of marriages don't have severe pathology. There isn't alcoholism, there isn't abuse, there isn't mental disorder. For the most part, it's two people who have stopped getting along. One of those areas, of course, is what do I do with my career and what do we do with these kids? Interestingly enough, Raymond, we live in a culture that says you can have sexual relationships with anybody, anytime, anywhere, just don't have more than 1.86 children in marriage, then we will belittle you.
Another interesting finding, and it brings us nicely to your book. 63% of divorced couples said having a better grasp of commitment prior to getting married could have helped them avoid divorce. Only 5% of couples said their marriages were irretrievably broken. Dr. Ray, tell us about Simple Steps to a Stronger Marriage. Why did you write it now? And are they right? What can you do to strengthen that bond, if you will, that understanding of commitment before you start the marriage?
A parent will walk into my office totally frustrated by their 7-year-old. There's no affection. There's no connection. They don't like being a parent to this child. I will give them a couple quick suggestions to try before the next time we meet. 50% of the time, Raymond, they will come back and they will say, I can't believe this. I'm living with a different child. He's more affectionate. He's happier. We fight less. I said, all I did was give you a couple simple steps. It was a cascade effect, Raymond. That's what I call it, which is these tiny little things you can do to improve your marriage have a reverberating effect throughout the whole marriage. Here's the problem. Any psychologist will tell you the hardest part of doing therapy is not so much knowing how to guide somebody. The hard part is convincing them to do it. In the book, I spend about 80% of my time convincing the people this is good for you to do for your marriage and for you.
Yeah. And you include a counseling scenario at the end of each chapter, which I like. Why did you decide to structure it that way? And how have readers responded? I'm sure they've called into the radio show and told you.
Well, my mom thinks it's one of the best books she's ever read. So that's good. That's a good thing. She didn't think that of the first few books. So this one she did. The reason I put those scenarios at the end is because people want real life stuff. They want to look at how things unfold. You don't want to just write a narrative and say, okay, here's what you do. You want to say, this is reality. Right. This is what you can expect. And here's a way to smooth this out. That's why I jump into the scenarios and I give suggestions on the spot.
In your introduction, you write this: to be sure, some marriages are seriously disturbed. They're plagued by major psychiatric disorders, spousal or child abuse, infidelity, alcohol and substance abuse. Overall, though, you mentioned this earlier, most struggling unions are not marked by severe pathologies. They are more accurately termed daily discontented. Overall, husband and wife want their marriage to work once they loved each other with more fervor, but their problems mounted over time and they drifted apart, or as life brought more stressors. Dr. Ray, explain what you mean by daily discontentment, and how can falling into that trap of complacency, giving up, best be avoided?
Raymond, are you familiar with the physics law, the law of entropy? Have you heard of it? It means everything decays, right? There is a parallel in marriages. I call it the law of social entropy. We get sloppy. We get lazy. We don't use manners like we used to. We don't compliment like we used to. We certainly don't say, I'm sorry. It's not so much necessarily that there's overt hostility. It's that we just drift into a sense of social apathy in a marriage. And that's what takes a lot of them down. The effort that needs to be put in is not there anymore. It's complacent.
Yeah, as I read the book, I kept thinking, you know, that old song, little things mean a lot. You know, that's the whole game. You cover a few of these simple steps in your book, and I want to dive into a few of them. Let's start at the beginning. And you mentioned a moment ago, saying I'm sorry. How can sincere apologies improve a marriage? And why does that go sideways, do you think?
I'll ask clients in my office, when is the last time either one of you said, I'm sorry? And I'll get answers like, when our child was in kindergarten. Well, how old's your child now? Oh, she's in law school. Well, wedding rehearsal dinner. I spilled coffee on her napkin and said, sorry about that. So you quickly realize, Raymond, that I'm sorry is about as pleasant in their marriage as a root canal. So given that, one of the main reasons people don't say I'm sorry, this is a big one, and most folks don't realize this in a marriage. If I can't say I'm sorry to you, it's because in my mind, I'm sorry doesn't mean for what I did at that time. It means you're better than me. It means I'm wrong, you're right. It means I'm inferior to you. It means I'm a failure. We fill it up with all kinds of extraneous psychological meaning, so we won't say I'm sorry because it means too much. There's something I call the personal apology percentage in the book. And this, Raymond, essentially says, how wrong do you have to be before you will say I'm sorry? Now, for most people, it's 50% or more. But in fact, especially among Christians, you should apologize for whatever percentage, independent of whether the other person says, I'm sorry for their 94%.
What I really like about the book is the common sense approach to communication. You know, like knowing when to hold your tongue, knowing the value of silence and listening. Talk for a moment about silence. How does silence complement listening to one's partner. And this should not be confused with the silent treatment.
Yes. There's two ways, Raymond. There's two levels. The first one is, most of the time when people say things they regret, it's at a moment of peak emotional surge. Mm. I'm upset. It's going to come out of my mouth. And later on, when I cool down. So one of the steps is, when you most feel like saying it, delay. Hold for 20 seconds, and the physiological urge, believe it or not, will taper enough for you to control it. That's the one level. The other level is this. Somebody will come in my office, and the woman will say, he does not stick up for me with his mother. I'll turn to the guy. Do you know why she thinks that? No. How long you been married? 24 years. Have you ever listened to why she thinks that? As a shrink, Raymond, I have to listen to people. And what I hear may shock me. It may make me tremble inside. But I have to listen. I have to understand what's going on in their head. Mm-hmm. Spouses have to understand what's going on in the other person's head. You may not agree with it. You may think it's ridiculous. You may think it's irrational and neurotic, but you gotta at least understand it. Most people want to be understood even more than they want to be agreed with.
Speak to something Mother Angelica used to talk about, and it was, you have to be in the present moment, and so many of us are living in the past or concerned and anxious about the future. What impact does that mode of thinking have on a marriage when you're just ruminating, digging through the yesterdays, or so anxious about the future, you're paralyzed?
I had a lady call me on the radio show. She said, my husband has not said I'm sorry in 52 years of marriage. Do you still get yourself upset over this? Yes. Why? Because he's never said I'm sorry. I said, well, you already know after 5 decades he's not going to say I'm sorry. When will you accept that? When will you say that is what he is, that is who he is, therefore I'm not going to look into the past and say, why doesn't he change? He can't make it any better. So typically in marriages, one of the big things, Raymond, is that we cling to former behaviors that hurt us. We don't let them go. We just grasp it, and we make ourselves miserable.
You write about something in the book called dumping the D word, divorce. Talk about the cavalier use of that word, particularly in a struggling marriage, and how it can be devastating.
The D word is the big club. If you don't realize how unhappy I am, maybe I'll start saying things like, maybe we're just better off apart. I think we ought to relook at this marriage and see if we were made for each other. So what we do is, I'm going to threaten you with this, because I want to shake you up. The problem with that, once you let that word enter your vocabulary, it becomes a possibility. Once you do that, you crack the door open to that option. Soon as couples come in my office, I will ask one very quick question. Is divorce an option? If they say no, I will say good. Now we can each do what we need to do, whatever it takes to make this marriage work. But if I have that option to get out of this, I'll only work at this so hard, because I can leave.
You devote a chapter to good old-fashioned manners in dealing with a spouse. How can something as simple as good manners save a struggling marriage? And why is that forgotten, do you think?
Many spouses don't have the manners of a five-year-old. Five-year-olds out in public get something from somebody. What do you say? What's the magic word? Many parents grab them and say thank you. We expect manners from five-year-olds. But in a marriage, we get very sloppy with our spouses. Hey, get me a cup of coffee, would you? We don't say please. When somebody has a meal that was prepared by a spouse, thank you. Boy, that was good. Thank you. Please, thank you. Those kinds of things express dignity, and we get sloppy with them. It's part of that law of social entropy, Raymond. We just get sloppy. We don't use the manners of a five-year-old with our spouses.
Talk to me for a moment about the small step of touch, how important a touch as a part of physical affection as a barometer of the health of a relationship.
There was a study done. They studied waitresses. And they noted that if a waitress touched a customer, that's all, nothing sexual, just hand on the shoulder, anything like that, they got 33% more tips. Touch conveys, yeah, I know. Touch conveys acceptance. A touch says a lot more silently than what I'd say with my mouth. And I'm amazed at how many people in my office come in and I ask them, when was the last time you had relations? A year and a half ago. When was the last time you hugged? When does Halley's Comet come around? Every 76 years, I think it is, something like that. They've given up. I tell guys, okay, if you're going to leave the house, say you're going to work, just touch your wife goodbye. It doesn't have to be anything fancy. Just touch her goodbye. Oh, I'm not an affectionate guy. Well, you don't have to be an affectionate guy. A touch is a step this big.
Mm-hmm. Well, but your first example, though, touching the waitress, that can land you in HR. So I wasn't talking about that kind of touch. I meant a touch at home with your spouse. I have to be very clear and put that forward. I take all these seminars on harassment. You got to be very careful today, Dr. Ray, very careful. According to one survey you cite in the book, when couples contemplating separation who stayed together were asked 5 years later about their relationship, 86% reported it was much improved. For anyone watching who might be in a difficult marriage, how can just being patient sometimes be the key to overcoming difficulties in a marriage? What would you tell people who don't think they can carry on any longer?
There's another part to that study, Raymond. They asked those folks right on the edge of divorce who got divorced. 5 years later, they said, are you happier now than you were when you were married? Are you more stressed now than you were when you were married? Half of them said that they are more unhappy now than they were when they were married. This is what I do in the office. People will say to me, how do you deal with someone who doesn't have any kind of moral commitment? Their view is, I don't like this. I met somebody else. I'm out of here. How do you deal with that? I say, well, one of the things I do is I walk them through the complications. So you have three children. Your daughter's what, 16? Do you think she'll have a relationship with you for breaking up her family? Oh, no, she's already not talking to me. I see. Well, this woman that you're with, does she have children? Oh, yeah, she's got an 8-year-old and 6-year-old, and they're both obnoxious little brats. Oh, do you think she'll allow you to discipline them? And what happens if you have a child by her? Do you think there'll be some favoritism you'll have to struggle with? I just walk them through the complications of this, and it indicates what can happen 5 years down the road when you think you're getting out of a bad marriage only to jump into a much more complicated situation. You've already lost two of your kids who won't talk to you because they're mad at you.
Right. And now you're in a worse situation than you were before, to say nothing of the payouts every month. I want to mention for a moment, because you brought it up earlier, and it's an important theme in the book. Tell me about faith, the power of faith, not only in a marriage, but to help in the reconciliation of a marriage and to avoid divorce.
It's very straightforward, Raymond. The studies are clear. If one spouse is faith-filled, the marriage has a much longer chance of success. If both spouses are faith-filled, the divorce rate is much, much lower. As a matter of fact, for example, among those spouses who practice natural family planning, the divorce rate is under 5%. The natural family planning indicates that they take their faith very seriously. So, in fact, I'm committed to this marriage, and I'm going to do what it takes to make it work. There's a place in the book where I say the number one way to change your spouse is to change you first. Now, people resist that, Raymond. They don't like looking at themselves first. But if you change you, and if you believe in a savior who says you need to be a better person, a better disciple, most spouses are going to respond at some level. They may not respond as much as you had hoped, but they are going to respond, unless they're Satan, they will indeed start to be a little easier to get along with.
Before we run out of time, what advice would you offer to single people out there who may be considering marriage? How can they prepare themselves? Also, those who might be engaged. I have a son who's about to get married. Not that I'm asking for free advice for him. I think he's okay. But about what the commitment to marriage requires before you say yes.
Excuse me, Raymond, just one second. Hey, guys, start the money thing on this for Raymond. Yeah, we're just starting the clock on it, Raymond, okay, if I'm giving you this advice. Okay. They say opposites attract. That's false. Opposites attract if you want an exciting relationship short term. Likes attract. I have seen many marriages fail because they didn't get to know each other enough and they didn't have enough commonality. The first commonality is faith. If you're marrying somebody that you think that you're going to bring around to the faith, good luck. That's the first thing. Secondly, take the time you need to really get to know this person. And by the way, you won't get to know them by living together, because the stats are real clear on that. Divorces are much higher when you live together first. That's a given. That shatters that cliche. Secondly, make sure this person views life as you do. Children, finances, family, parenting, people around them, the sphere. But most important, Raymond, and this is the toughest part now with young people who are faith-filled, is to find a potential spouse who takes the faith like you do. That is getting much tougher.
Well, your book, Simple Steps to a Stronger Marriage by Dr. Ray Guarendi, is available at bookstores everywhere online, including EWTN's catalog, EWTNRC.com.
That is all the time we have for now. Be sure to catch us next week. Until then, we'll be scouting the world over for all that is seen and unseen. On behalf of the staff and crew of EWTN News, thank you for watching. I'm Raymond Arroyo. Bye now.